Lawrence seemed silent and rather thunderstruck by the letters having come so quickly, although Temeraire thought that it was more peculiar and embarrassing that they should take quite so long to come from England.
"They might at least bring letters by courier to somewhere that does not need so much flying across the open ocean, perhaps from Macassar, where those fishermen were from," Temeraire said, "and then they might row it across and Chun Li bring them to us in Sydney. That would not be quite so fast, but it would not take 8 months. What good is a letter 8 months late when everything must be changed? One might as well write stories that were quite made up. One might say, 'Oh, I have just received a bag of lovely pearls,' and if ever a reply came asking to see, one might say, 'Why, that was a year ago. They are all gone now.'"
Lawrence began to write a letter himself, to Arthur Hammond, the envoy in Peking. Temeraire did not remember him very fondly, as it had been very clear that Hammond would have been perfectly delighted to trade him away for any advantage he might get in the way of ports or of shipping, and Temeraire had felt this was not merely a great misjudgment of his value to England, but also more than a little rude. But in the end Hammond had proven very useful, and had worked out the very many confusing details of the adoption, and Temeraire had grown quite reconciled to him, so he was telling Lawrence to send Hammond his best wishes when Mr. Chakwa came into the pavilion in search of Jia Jun.
"I am sorry to run out before dinner, more than myself than for you, to tell the truth," he said, "but I had better. A frigate has just heaved up over the horizon, and she isn't flying any colours. But I think I know British handling when I see it, and I don't care to have half my best men pressed. No offence to you, sir," he added, giving Lawrence a small bow, "but the Navy has been getting a little unreasonable about it. We objected in 76, and we'll object again if we have to."
"Why," Temeraire said to Lawrence, "surely that means we do not have to hurry away at all. Now they must know for certain."
"Yes," Lawrence said grimly, "now they know."
Chapter 16. The frigate might be seen from shore before dusk fell, and a little after a sloop of war sailing in company.
"That is the Nereid, I think," Lawrence said,
looking through his glass for what he could glimpse of the bow.
"She was sent with the expeditionary force to Ile-de-France by my last Gazette under Corbett."
He did not share what he had heard of that officer. A hard-knocks captain, court-martialed for brutality, anything might have changed in half a year, and rumour might be mistaken.
"I suppose," Granby said reluctantly. "Caesar is the only one who can go," Lawrence said. "Neither Iskierka nor Temeraire could land upon the ship, and I have no confidence they would listen to Demain. Or for that matter to me. The captain can scarcely have failed to hear of my case."
"I don't know, I wouldn't rather wait until he was close enough to row out to,"
Granby muttered. But there was no help for it. They could not, with any conscience at all, allow a British company to approach without speaking to them, so Rankin must go with them. In any case, he was scarcely waiting for their opinion on the matter, and had already gone to dress. Caesar was arranged upon the shore, waiting, preening with self-importance.
"Well, we are glad enough to find you," Willoughby said.
Nesbit, Willoughby, captain of the Nereid, having supplanted Corbett in that position after, he said, the successful taking of Réunion, which had been undertaken under Commodore Rowley to secure a port in place of the lost Cape Town. But Lawrence could not take any great comfort in the substitution. Willoughby had himself been charged with cruelty before a court-martial in his previous command, and the ship did not have a happy air. There was a lowering stiffness everywhere, and Caesar was looked upon with a wariness more intimate than mere reflexive anxiety. These were men who feared punishment, and feared it might grow worse.
"Not," Willoughby continued, "that I imagine we will have any great difficulty. I wonder at them, indeed, planting themselves here, cool as you please, not a single possession nearer than 4,000 miles, and only that one floundering mess of a junk to defend it, other than the Dragons, of course, and I'm relieved to hear they have only the one they stole. I believe we cannot expect to recapture her?" he inquired.
"Sadly," Rankin said,
"I'm afraid the beast has been too thoroughly suborned to permit us to entertain any such hope. Several of my officers, some effrontery in that which Lawrence controlled himself from remarking upon, have attempted to entice her back, but she has rejected wholly all the lures. Her egg was in their possession too long."
Willoughby nodded.
"Well, it is a shame," he said, "but at least we cannot be too worried about her, new-hatched and untrained. I suppose they will strike their colours at once when we have made clear the situation, in any case."
"And what is that situation?"
Lawrence said, a little sharply, and Willoughby looked at him with disfavour.
"I do not much care for your presence at this conference, in any case, Mr. Lawrence," he said, "and I will thank you to keep silent. I do not propose to answer to the inquisition of a convicted traitor."
"Captain Willoughby,"
Lawrence said, too impatient to tolerate this, "I must beg you to imagine my own interest in either your feelings or your opinion of myself, when I have allowed no similar consideration for those who had greater claims by far to alter my course. And if you dislike my company, you may be shot of it all the sooner if you will not stand upon some notion of preserving ceremony, in circumstances so wholly irregular and unexpected, unless you imagine that a 20-ton celestial will have any more patience for it than do I." Rankin looked away, as though to express silently his mortification at Lawrence's crudeness. Captain Tomkinson of the Otter covered his mouth and issued a cough, soft and uncomfortable. Granby only did not see anything awkward in the speech, and added,
"And speaking of whom, if you do mean to make some noise, you wouldn't be glad to have found us. Temeraire won't in the least sit still for your having at these fellows, and I don't suppose any of the other beasts will care to disoblige him. I don't know what Captain Rankin may have said about seniority, which is a right enough mess between us presently, but he knows very well that it don't make a lick of difference to them. What are your orders?"
Willoughby frowned. He was a narrow-faced man whose hair had already crept back along the curve of his skull, and he was not particularly well-dressed. His clothes were those of a man who had been at sea for 8 months, and lodging in irregular shelters. But Granby had given him an excuse, and it was to Granby he answered.
"Our orders," with emphasis, "are to take the port, and if it will not be surrendered, gentlemen, I will take it. I will take it if I have to shell it to the very earth."